Hello and welcome to Pardis from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardis Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardis alum. This week, Shemini. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Parsha Shemini. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardis faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. So welcome to all of our listeners, and I hope that everybody had a good Purim. We certainly had a wonderful Purim here at Pardis. And this week we're going to talk about Parsha Shemini. It was on the eighth day, and what I'd like to talk about is what exactly is this eighth day? What, the eighth day of what? And what happens on this eighth day? So this is the eighth day of the dedication of the tabernacle, the eighth day of the dedication of the Mishkan. For 7 days, as we read in Vayikra and Leviticus chapter 8, for 7 days there's an order of inauguration. For 7 days each day, the priests put on their special robes and bring a unique order of sacrifices. And it is the end of the seventh day. And this has been prescribed already in Exodus. We were told that they were meant to have a seven-day inauguration procedure. Suddenly we hear about an eighth day. We didn't know about this before. And this eighth day is described in a very auspicious way. Moses says to Aaron, take yourself a calf of a sin, as a sin offering, a ram as a burnt offering, unblemished, and bring them before God. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them to bring various sacrifices. Why? Because he says, today the Lord shall appear to you. Ki hayom Hashem nira alechem. And Moses commands the people, the entire community should approach before the Lord, and the Lord shall appear to you. Okay. Let the presence of God appear to you. On this eighth day, after a week, 7 days of the inauguration of the temple, we get to the eighth day, and this is going to be a day of revelation. How does God reveal himself on this special occasion? We read it at the end of the chapter. It's quite an incredible scene. It says the following. Aaron raised his hands, Vayisa Aaron et Yadav, towards the people and blessed them. He came down from the altar from making the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offering. Vayered me'asot ha'chatat v'ha'ola v'ha'shlamim. And then Moses and Aaron entered the tent of meeting. They came out again, and fire emanated from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fats on the altars. All the people saw, and they praised and fell on their faces. Vateitze esh m'lifnei Hashem, v'tochal al mizbeach ha'ta'ola v'tachalavim, v'yar kol ha'am v'yaronu v'yaplu al pneihem. Fire came out from God, consumed the sacrifices. Everybody falls down as the fire of the Lord comes out from the tabernacle, consumes the sacrifices, and they somehow praise God. This is quite a dramatic end to the 8 days, which are meant to be the dedication of the temple. And we sort of wonder, you know, where exactly to place this revelation. This moment I'd like to contrast with another depiction of the inauguration of the Mishkan. Because, and in fact, the inauguration of the tabernacle is one of the most the events which gets the widest coverage in the Torah. It's already been described in another book. In the closing lines of Shemot, we read this: on the day that the Mishkan was dedicated, the first of Nisan, we read the following: the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the Lord's glory filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the Lord's glory filled the tabernacle. What I'm trying to illustrate is actually that this event is covered from two different vantage points, but in very, very divergent ways. In the book of Vayikra, Parashat Shemini, we describe a sacrificial ceremony happening on the eighth day of the dedication of the Mishkan. And there, after bringing all the sacrifices, Aaron comes down from bringing the sacrifices, and fire comes out from inside the tabernacle and eats them up. And this is dramatic, and the people all bow down. However, the dedication of the tabernacle is described very differently at the end of Shemot, at the end of Exodus. There, it is not on the altar that God manifests itself, but it's inside the tent of meeting. There, in the tent of meeting, God manifests himself not in fire, but rather in a cloud. And I want to... I'm wondering and I'm pondering why the dedication of the emergent temple, the tabernacle, is described in such different ways. In one, it's fire. In the other one, it's cloud. In one, it's on the altar. In the other, it's in the tent. In one, the person who is at the center of the drama is Aaron. Aaron comes down from bringing the sacrifices. In the other story, the story with the cloud, It says, Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it. Moses is at the focus. What's the difference? Let's try and think about, first maybe we'll start by thinking about these two substances, cloud and fire. Well, we're familiar with God being manifested in cloud and fire. If you recall, we know about the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire which lead them out of Egypt. We read in Shemot chapter 13 that the Lord went before them as they're coming out of Egypt. The Lord traveled ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so they may travel day and night. He did not remove the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night, but in front of the people. At the revelation at Mount Sinai, at Matan Torah, once again, we see Anan Kaved Alahar, a very, very powerful presence of a cloud on the mountain, which manifests God resting on the mountain, but God is also depicted as being Ke'esh Ochelet Barosh Ahar, like a consuming fire on the mountain. Sometimes God is described in fire, for example, in the burning bush, but at other times, when God speaks to the people, it says, and the cloud descended upon the tent. What is this idea of God being manifest in fire and cloud? Of course, they seem to represent some sort of contrast. On the one hand, fire maybe is a warmth, something which we need. Cloud indicates possibly moisture. So it could be water, you know, fire and water, warmth and moisture, maybe. Possibly we could look at it as some other idea. Sorry about the siren in the background. We'll let that go past. We could describe this in a different way. Cloud represents protection from the sun, right? Whereas it could be that the pillar of fire represents light, two modes of God protecting us. The cloud by day shields us from the harsh sun in the desert. The light at night gives us, the fire at night gives us light. So these are two modes of protection. In these cases, these are complementary, the moisture and the warmth, the fire and the water, the light and protection. However, you know, they could actually be a contrast. Fire seems very, very different to cloud. One could argue like this. Fire represents clarity. Light, clarity. We can see when we have light. On the other hand, a cloud usually obscures. A cloud, we can't see past it, right? And therefore, it could be that these somehow... Why are these representations of God, right? It could be that God represents that which is clear, which is bright, which is light, which gives energy. On the other hand, cloud, it represents something which is impenetrable, which is like a screen which we cannot penetrate. Very interesting metaphors for the divine or manifestations of the divine. Let me say two other things about cloud and fire. Of course, these are in some way essential, the cloud which gives us the water, and fire, which gives us warmth and cooks our food. But on the other hand, both of these things can be intensely scary if they come in an uncontrolled fashion. Of course, a cloud which comes down and becomes a thick fog means that we simply cannot function. We don't know where we are. We're disoriented. Likewise, a fire, when it's uncontrollable, is something exceedingly dangerous. And therefore, I think they in some way represent God, that when God is in a state of control, if you want to put it, they are nourishing. They are something which feeds human beings in their most immediate need. But when it's in a state of lack of control, it's something terrifying and overwhelming. And therefore, I think we can understand that these two modes of manifestation of God, the fire and the cloud, are very interesting in the way that they depict God. But I want to come back to this idea. Why do we need two descriptions of the dedication of the temple? Some will argue that in fact these happen at a remove of a week from one to the other. God appears in cloud on the first day, but he appears in fire on the eighth day. And we have this very fascinating cycle of 7 days of preparation and then moving to an eighth day. This is, by the way, very familiar. These cycles of seven plus one are very familiar to us from the book of Vayikra, where in the book of Vayikra, we frequently have 7 days of impurity, 7 days of purification, and on the eighth day, one is pure. This is true about the Haftarah that we'll read this week, Parashat Parah, which describes purification from coming into contact with the dead, where there are 7 days in which one undergoes a process of purification, and on the eighth day, one emerges from it. It's true at the beginning of next week's Parshat Shavua, Isha ki tazria v'yalda zachar, a week following the birth, and on the eighth day, the male child, is circumcised. What's this idea of maybe 7 days followed by an eighth day? Maybe before I get to the answer that I would like to say, let me mention a further idea. There's a fascinating discussion around the topic of Shabbat. What happens if somebody wakes up on a desert island, shipwrecked, and cast away, and they don't know what day of the week it is? And the Talmud in Shabbat debates what day you should keep Shabbat. Of course you should keep Shabbat, but which day? One opinion says that you should count 6 days, and the seventh day you should keep it as Shabbat. The other opinion says no, keep the first day as Shabbat, and then count 6 days and go from there. What's the basis of each? Well, one opinion says that it is objective. In the book of Genesis, we have 6 days of the world, and the seventh day is the Sabbath. The other opinion says, no, it's subjective, because Adam, of course, is created on the sixth day. So his first day on this earth is Shabbat. From the human perspective, our first day is Shabbat, and 6 days follow. When you think about this, this really raises the question, is Shabbat the final day of the week, or is it the first day of the week? And there's a famous concept which says that if the people of Israel kept two Shabbats appropriately, the Messiah would come. I have no idea how to verify this particular tradition, but what's the idea? Why two Shabbatot? Why two Shabbats, not one? And the idea is there's one Shabbat which begins the week, and there's one Shabbat which ends the week. Or I'll put it differently. Hopefully, the week which follows Shabbat is infused with a certain spirituality, with a certain direction. Shabbat, in that sense, begins the week. Shabbat is the starting point. It's the launch pad. It's the springboard from where we launch our week. On the other hand, Shabbat in some way is the end of the week. It's the culmination of the week. It's where our whole week is setting to. Our week begins with a spiritual orientation. It has a spiritual vector, but it also crescendos in a sense of bringing all our everything we've achieved during the week and our work and sort of funneling that into a culmination of Shabbat. In that regard, maybe we need the Shabbat at the beginning of the week and at the end of the week, and these are two manifestations of Shabbat. I say this because it's fascinating that we see this week Yom HaShmini. It's the notion of the eighth day. And I wanted to explain this with an idea of Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, where Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch wants to argue that it's almost like a musical octave. We talk about an octave, but there are really only seven notes in an octave. The eighth note is back to A, okay? In other words, the octave really only has seven notes. And when we reach the eighth note is the first note, A, but it's an octave higher. It's one key higher. And that exactly is meant to be the concept of the Yom HaShmini. The idea is you go through one ordinary cycle of 7 days, and then on the eighth day we suddenly find ourselves a whole floor higher, a whole level higher, an octave higher. This is the idea of progress that is depicted in the dedication of the Mishkan. On the first day of the eighth day, God manifests himself in cloud and to Moses. And this is an initial moment of revelation, which, if you want, kickstarts the tabernacle. But in this week's Parashat Shavua, we now see the eighth day. We've already gone through a week of inauguration, a week of divine service. And suddenly, after doing all that divine service, God blesses us with another moment of revelation in his other form of manifestation, not in cloud, but rather in fire. And this is almost like the culmination, the closing ceremony of the inaugural events, where we've now raised ourselves to a higher octave. We've now started the week with a moment of godliness, and we've ended the week with this moment of godliness. And this classic pattern, which we find also in the, for example, in the festival of Sukkot, one day in which we have Yom Tov, which we have a holy day, then we have another 6 days, and then the eighth day, Shmini Atzeret, is a moment once again in which we communicate and convene with God. This represents a classic paradigm. Again, the moment of birth, and then on the eighth day, the moment of circumcision, following this cycle of the octave. So what I've tried to depict is this idea that really there is this engagement. This is meant to be a tent of meeting. God's residence. Mishkan means God's residence. The idea is in some way that there will be a meeting point, a rendezvous with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God. And this indeed happens on the first day and on the eighth. But I'd like to deal a little bit with the difference, because I've dealt with cloud and fire both as manifestations of God, but is there any difference? And here I would like to describe the fact that the inauguration of the temple is actually described not only in two books, but in three. And each book gives a coverage of the inauguration which matches that book. Let's begin in the book of Shemot. In the book of Shemot, what does it tell us about the inauguration of the temple? It says, the cloud covered the tent of meeting, the Lord's glory filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it. The Lord's glory filled the tabernacle. Here the central person is Moses, and the central feature is the cloud. And this reminds us of the cloud on Mount Sinai. And if you recall, the whole drama of the book of Exodus is about us becoming a people and God being in our midst. The calamity of the sin of the golden calf made God leave the midst of the camp. In fact, God parked the tent of God was parked far outside the camp, and every time God wanted to talk to Moses, he came down in a cloud. The drama at the end of the book is that with the tabernacle set up in the center of the camp, God is manifest in the camp. How? With the same cloud with which he was manifest at Mount Sinai, it's now in the center of the camp. God is amongst the people. V'asuli migdash v'shachanti b'tocham. The clear key leadership figure who has featured throughout the book of Exodus, Moses, is centrally featuring here. Moses cannot talk to God because there is a cloud there. God is so manifest that he is really at the epicenter of the camp. And this is the culmination of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, because it wants to show that not that just we're just a free people, but that we are God's people. God is amongst us. God lives at the epicenter of the camp. That is the critical thing. That's the story of the dedication of the temple in the book of Exodus. Let's turn to the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. Everybody knows that Leviticus focuses, at least its beginning, on sacrifices. And therefore, the Torah wants to tell us the story of the dedication of the temple from the perspective of the book of Leviticus, what does it describe? It says, if you bring sacrifices, and who should bring the sacrifices? The priests, not Moses, Aaron. Aaron and his sons, if you bring the sacrifices according to the prescribed order, I will manifest myself. Where? Not in the tent. Outside, on the altar, and not through cloud, but through fire, I will eat up the sacrifices. God, if you want, has left the world of Shemot behind. It's not about God's soothing presence in the tent. It's now about God as being willing to receive the sacrifices. Where? On the altar outside. By whom? By Aaron. So we see a whole different vantage point, another take, another angle, another perspective on God's willing acceptance of the gifts of Bnei Israel. However, there is a third time that this event is depicted, and that is in Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, chapter 7. Let me just read a little bit of what we hear there. It says, and it was, chapter 7 of Bamidbar of Numbers, on the day that Moses completed setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it, sanctified it, and all its utensils. The tribal leaders of Israel, heads of their paternal houses, came forward. They're the leaders of the tribes, those who oversee the counting, and they brought their contributions before God. 6 covered wagons and 12 oxen, a wagon for each of the two leaders and an ox for each one. And Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. And they're given to the Levites so that they can transport the tabernacle. What's remarkable here is we don't see Moses, we don't see Aaron, we don't see sacrifices or divine clouds. We see here a group of politicians, tribal leaders, and they say, wait, don't leave us behind. Don't leave the people behind. This is not just about Moses and Aaron. The people also want to celebrate the inauguration of the temple. And what do they bring? Here we see political leaders, and they bring, you know, mundane things. They bring wagons. They bring oxen. Later on, we find they bring silver bowls. Okay? They bring spoons. They bring sprinkling basins. They bring all sorts of tableware to the Mishkan. This is a third depiction, a depiction from the perspective of the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, which tells the story from the perspective of the nation. To what can this be compared? Sometimes you could have, I don't know, a convention of international leaders, and you have the political correspondent describing it from one angle. You would have the gossip columnist describing it from another angle. You would have, I don't know, maybe the financial correspondent or whatever it might be, describing it from another angle. Each book of the Torah has its agenda. The book of Exodus is interested in the communion between nation and God. and whether God is going to be amongst his people, the key figure being Moses. The book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, interested in the sacrifices. Key figure, Aaron. Key substance of Revelation, fire, eating up sacrifices. We get to the book of Bamidbar. This is the book of the people. And so who do we want to dedicate the Mishkan there? We see a third snapshot, third image, third area of coverage. Here we see the people's leaders, the diplomats, the mayors of each tribe, who we call the Nisim, the princes of the tribes, each come forward. And what do they bring? No, they don't bring sacrifices. They bring wagons, oxen, tableware for the tabernacle. And how does God reveal himself in this particular instance? It's not going to be the cloud which restricts Moses. It's not going to be the fire which burns up the sacrifice. It's going to be something far more essential for the Jewish people. The end of that chapter 7 in Bamidbar ends with the following line. It says, when Moses would enter the tent of meeting to speak with God, he would hear the voice speaking to him over the cover that is on the Ark of Testimony from between the two cherubim. After the leaders bring all of their gifts, how does God reward the leaders? He tells Moses and instructs him the instructions that we need in order to make our way through the wilderness, in order to live our lives according to Jewish tradition. What can we learn from this story for ourselves? I think what we need to learn is that every single event which takes place, every encounter with Judaism, can be manifest in different ways to different people. Sometimes we have to see the cloud, sometimes we have to see the fire, sometimes we have to see the divine word. Sometimes the person who it will be addressed will be Moses, sometimes Aaron, sometimes the people's representatives. But every encounter with Judaism is an opportunity that whoever you are, there is a vantage point which can speak to you. This is a critical national moment. The establishment of the hub, the religious center of the Jewish people. In our times, we always talk about either the home or the synagogue as being a mikdash ma'at, a small and miniature sanctuary. And it is essential for us that every single group amongst the Jewish people feel that this is an access point for them. I think that the Torah deliberately describes this event three times in three different books to teach us this message, to tell us that whoever you are and whatever you are, you can encounter God as long as you approach it as you and look for the way in which God will be able to reveal himself to you in that moment of encounter. Wishing everybody a wonderful week and a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.